Welcome to today's Purposeful Planning Institute webinar. The title of today's session is Generation Impact. Next Gen Donors are Revolutionizing Giving. Our guest thought leader today is Sharna Goldsucker, Executive Director at 2164, and our host is John A. Warnick. I'd like to share a purposeful quote, and then I'll turn it over to you, John A. Our quote today is by Carlos Santana. There is no greater reward than working from your heart and making a difference in the world. So thanks again, everyone, for joining us. And John A., I'll turn it over to you.
Well, thank you, Julie, and thank you, everyone, for joining us today. This is going to be a very powerful conversation with Sharna around her new book. Sharna, you have been on at least one, if not several, other PPI Weekly Thought Leader and Industry Innovator teleconferences and webinars. And but there still may be many on the call today who don't fully know your story. So I'd like to ask you, if you would, to have you share your purposeful odyssey, that 3 to 5 minute description of the journey you've been on that has brought you to where you are today, that describes the why and how you are serving families and individuals. And perhaps you could give us a little hint of the impact that you're personally seeking to have on the world, which I think is very positive and very huge. So could you share your purposeful odyssey with us?
Thanks for having me back, John A. It's always an honor to be with you all. Delighted to share a little bit of my backstory. I really come to this work wearing two hats, a personal as well as professional one. I like to say I'm originally from Baltimore, Maryland. If anyone's taken an Amtrak train down the Northeast Corridor or watched the HBO show The Wire, to the chagrin of many Baltimore residents, that's often how others know it. But my grandfather and great uncle immigrated to Baltimore in the early 1900s. My grandpa set up a grocery store, and his brother started to buy row houses that you see from the train window as you're passing by the town. And that business did a little better than the grocery store, and so everyone, including my father, moved into the family business. And my father likes to say he worked, 18 years, 6 days a week, no vacations, no sick days. It was part of the legacy of the family. And when his uncle passed away, his uncle didn't have, he wasn't married, he didn't have children of his own. And when the will was read, this is not how I recommend succession planning, by the way, to discover only from a trust and estate attorney what your next steps are. My father discovered that he was to set up a charitable foundation in his uncle's name to benefit disadvantaged people of Baltimore, really, where he had his life and his company, he wanted to give back. And so my father, this happened the year before I was born. I was born in 1974, 43, just to be transparent. And I watched as my father stepped into the role of not just working in real estate, but understanding what it meant to steward someone's philanthropic legacy. So I'll just say another couple words, John A., and turn it back over to you. But I, went on this journey of learning what it meant to be involved in philanthropy. And I felt what, Warren Buffett now says, to have inherited the ovarian lottery. Like, I really thought, wow, how do I have this opportunity that other people don't? And yet I didn't feel like I had earned the right to that legacy. I hadn't earned the wealth. And because of where I was born, I had this privilege of helping to steward it. And so I went on my own journey to understand what that meant to me. I interned at the Baltimore Community Foundation and the Association of Baltimore Area Grant Makers. I worked in affordable housing development in the neighborhoods where my grandfather had a grocery store for a lot of years. And I just tried to really appreciate the work and the needs of the community from the ground up. Along the way, I also was asked for money often, having the same last name as one of the top 10 foundations in the community. And again, felt like, what does it mean to be in this role? Met a number of other next gen who were similarly asked to be the next generation before stepping into their own identity, their own voice, their own roles. As our friend and colleague, John A. Kristen Keffler has said to me, next gen often feel paralyzed by predecessor and the success of those who've come before them, or paralyzed by privilege, how come I have this and others don't, or paralyzed by possibilities of what they could do in the world. And that has always resonated with me. And so my professional hat in the last 15, 20 years has been to help next gen find their purpose, to really help them find their philanthropic identity. And ironically, a lot of what we've learned in next gen has informed my work in family philanthropy and next gen education to participate in family offices and other kinds of family enterprise endeavors. So, you know, still run next generation peer retreats and coaching, consult to multi-generational families who want to engage their next gen, train advisors who want to serve families in that capacity, and build tools, the latest of which, of course, is the Generation Impact book, to help inform the field about what we've been learning over time. So maybe I'll pause there, but I appreciate the question. It's definitely been a labor of love for me to do this work. I'm happy to share some of my findings today.
I'm going to go from mute to unmute and hope that the background noise isn't quite so severe for the brief time I'm going to ask this question. Sharna, that was a wonderful, purposeful odyssey, and I love what you shared from Kristen's contribution to your odyssey. I would just say Sharna has really done an amazing job of creating tools and processes and training that is delivered through 2164. So if you are not familiar with 2164, please dive in. And I know Kristen Keffler and many others within the PPI community have gone through the training that Sharna has created and offers there. So Sharna, getting back to Generation Impact, it's going to be the focus of our conversation today. I feel from my reading that it's going to significantly magnify the influence that the PPI community can have, and it's going to create ripples of positive impact in the way that advisors, consultants, family office professionals who belong to our PPI community engage with families, particularly with the rising generation of donors. So before we dive into several of the key points of the book, let me just ask you to share with us the why behind Generation Impact. Why did you and Michael Moody write this book? And how long has this idea taken from formation, germination, into blossoming with its publication and distribution in the last 4 to 6 months?
Sure. And thank you for your kind words. It means a lot coming from you, John A. You know, first of all, I should say, Michael Moody is my co-author, and we had met a number of years ago, and he was working in Richmond, Virginia, and he was appointed the first endowed chair of family philanthropy in the country at Grand Valley State University in Michigan. He was heading out there, and I said, you know, what are you going to do in your job? And he said, the unique thing about the university where I'm going is that we don't want to just do research for the ivory tower. We want to do research that's going to serve the field. You have any ideas? And I said, well, let's talk about the next gen donors who I think are going to be the most significant in history. And of course, he lit up and he said, of course, because, you know, not only will they have unprecedented financial resources to give, but they also want to start giving now, right? Rather than waiting developmentally as previous generations have done. If we think about sort of iconic Gilded Age philanthropists like Andrew Carnegie or Julius Rosenwald, John D. Rockefeller, you know, we think about them in their late adulthood, leaving their legacy of philanthropy, whereas next gen donors today want to make an impact now and are starting to give at much earlier stages in their lives. So We know we're in the largest wealth concentration that we've seen to date. 1% of the population of the United States owns 43% of the wealth in the country. Of course, we're also amid the greatest wealth transfer in history. Just to note the significance, you know, if you would take the corporation in America who brings in the most annual revenue, it's Walmart, $486 billion in 2016. It would take 121 years of Walmart generating that revenue to reach the $59 trillion that's currently being transferred to Gen X and millennials in the largest wealth transfer in history. So we definitely have an unprecedented set of resources going to people who feel like there are great social ills in our society, entrenched problems that they want to work on, and they're not waiting till the sunset of their lives to do so, but they want to give throughout their lifetime. And they're really embracing whatever innovations or changes seem to be emerging in the field in order to make the kind of impact that they want to have. And so Michael and I fielded a national survey with the help of 18 other organizations that helped us get the word out and conducted dozens of in-depth interviews. We did an original report a couple of years back and then said, this is too important, and went back and finished 75 interviews to put together Generation Impact, which came out in October. And 13 of those 75, a baker's dozen, allowed us to not keep them anonymous, but to invite them to tell first person stories, to really share. You know, we felt like so many people in the field were talking about next gen donors, and we wanted to bring the voices of next gen donors themselves to the fore and help share their stories. Some of them speaking out for the first time publicly with the larger field. And then lastly, I would just say the orientation of the book isn't just to the next gen donors. We wanted to offer suggestions, ideas, implications to families who are trying to engage their next gen advisors, trying to serve them. And really anyone who's serving on a nonprofit board, right, or helping to be part of their communities, because we felt like this generation of folks are going to have an impact in how they allocate their resources on our communities, our economies, our health, our culture, even our climate.
Well, let me just echo that I believe the book does just exactly what you described in terms of reaching all of those different potential readers and users of the practical wisdom that was captured. And I love, Sharna, the approach that you and Michael took of bringing the voices of these givers into the book rather than just writing about them. That is very obvious to me, and it's what I think is responsible for a lot of the appeal that the book has. I think that everyone on the call today is aware of the profound differences between the generations of the multi-generational families that we all serve. In fact, PPI has a dean, Lisa Gray Niemeyer, who's a fan of Sharna and the work of 2164, a big fan. And Lisa has, you know, focused on generational impact and differences. So could you help us, Sharna, understand what are the key differences that you see between more traditional donors that perhaps most of our listeners have been focused on or working with, and this new generation of givers? Is there a story in your experience and your work which comes to mind that would help sharpen the difference between the attitudes and habits of the senior generation donors and the rising generations, which I'm assuming would be largely composed of the Gen Xers, and now, watch out, here come the millennials. That this is really who the rising generation is, right?
Yes, we interviewed 20 and 30 somethings from high capacity families. So that would be younger Gen X as well as millennials. You know, we found that they are so focused, if Michael were here, he would say obsessed with impact, that we called it an impact revolution, that they're eager to make change and whatever needs to change, even if it makes people uncomfortable, to disrupting or asking for, you know, evolutions, revolutions, if doing so will help move the needle on some of our biggest challenges across the globe. We asked on our national survey, we gave survey responders 23 possible choices that they could rank about their reasons for giving. We asked them to note the reasons for giving, and we looked at the top three. They always included impact. Quote, seeking my contribution would make a real difference in the an organization to have real impact. I mean, it is a prioritization for them. It is a passion. In fact, when we were often asked what causes next-gen donors care about, and we found there was less actually difference. People, traditional, as you said, put it, donors, seasoned donors, other generations may feel comfortable to know that the key causes of previous generations prioritized, like education and basic needs, are still priorities for this generation. But it is how they're funding, not so much what they're funding, but how they're funding, how they're prioritizing impact that makes them stand out. Again, not that other generations don't want to make a difference with their giving, but the lengths that this generation will go to for that impact really is what's standing out here. One gentleman we interviewed said, I traveled with a small team to see a situation face to face and traveled to Central Africa, which is much better than seeing it in an abstract way, sitting around a board table in a Manhattan office. Or, you know, we interviewed Daniel Lorre, who is featured in the book. If you've from the Bay Area, you may recognize the name. Daniel helped to set up the Tipping Point community, where he's leveraged over $150 million from peers in that community to set up a new model of attacking poverty, where they're focusing on a set amount of grantees, about 40 grantees. They're asking them, not telling them what's best for them, but asking them sort of, how do you think we can best approach addressing poverty in this community? Collecting data to understand what of their strategies work and what doesn't, offering them R&D money, just like the corporate sector would, to invest in new experiments to affect poverty, funding operating, not just program grants, so forth and so on. So, you know, Daniel likes to say, you can't keep doing the same things over and over again and expecting better results. You know, if we want real results that are desperately needed, we have to do something different to move the needle. So, lots more stories I could offer on impact, but I think that's the primary difference we're seeing between previous donor generations. You know, NextGen said, we assume that our parents and our grandparents are more motivated in their giving by a feeling of obligation or responsibility or even relationships that they might have in the community. We're focusing on impact first.
I think that's very helpful. In one of the chapters, Sharna, you, I think the title to the chapter is Why Not Innovate? And it really harvests some, I think, exciting glimpses into the ways in which the rising generation of givers is disrupting the more traditional models and really bringing innovation. Could you share a couple of those glimpses and give us some ideas of how strong this disruptive influence is?
Sure. I mean, I think that the next generation is just embracing innovation in an effort to find solutions that are going to affect the kind of impact we want to have, you know, to improve society's challenges. So, you know, I think about one next-gen donor we interviewed who's in the technology sector. He's an investor in Silicon Valley. And he said, you know, where the majority of people go, I look the other way. You know, I'm trying to find sort of the outliers, not where the median is conforming, because I think that's where some of the greatest new solutions of our day will come. You know, so we saw NextGen being willing to invest in a variety of new approaches that are not your typical check writing or grant making. So I think about Justin Rockefeller and his sister Valerie Wayne, who participated on the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, who said, you know, we're not just going to look at the 5% that the foundation is investing in climate change and other peace building solutions. We're going to look at the 95% of the assets and how we're allocating and investing those in order to make a greater impact there. And so many of you may recall in 2014, they were part of the investment committee and the board of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund that approved divesting from fossil fuels so that they weren't harming the environment that they were trying to support on the grant making side. The irony, of course, being that the Rockefeller money came from investments in oil and gas. So, you know, recently having sat on a panel with Justin just last week, you know, he talks about wanting to use all the tools on his tool belt to affect change. And in that case, you know, using asset allocation is one of them. We also saw other next gen, you know, who are investing in C4s for political advocacy in addition to funding C3s, who are using crowdfunding and crowdsourcing platforms. People who are willing to invest in for-profit social enterprises that are having an impact, you know, not just again on the nonprofit side, but on the for-profit side for social change. So, you know, all kinds of what I think other generations might call risk-taking. This generation feels like it's risky not to innovate and try new approaches for affecting change.
Another surprising takeaway for me, but after I reflected on it, I don't know that it should have been all that surprising, Sharna, is the point that you make that not only does this rising generation want to be innovative and they want to have greater impact than previous generations, but there is a difference, a fundamental difference in the way that they want to engage. They aren't just about writing checks. They want to go all in, as you put it. And could you share with us what you've observed about this facet of their mindset and how it's changing their relationship with traditional charities, causes, even their communities, and help us understand what to expect from what they expect from those who would want to partner with them or be the recipients of their generosity or their impact?
Yes, I appreciate you lifting up this aspect of the book, of the findings, because I think it's so interesting, this generation. You know, I know older generations and nonprofits say, how do we get the next gen involved? And here we had next gen who were saying, we don't want to just be involved, we want to go all in. You know, so I think what's happening is they're looking for ways to have meaningful engagement rather than many surface level experiences, a few very focused opportunities where they can go all in and give of their time, their talent, their treasure, and what we're adding to this story, ties. So for example, you know, we appreciate the phrase do something. You know, we call them the do something generation, just like there's a very successful nonprofit organization called Do Something, which engages millennials in volunteerism. We're seeing this generation want to give of their time, you know, and we interviewed Victoria Rogers, who grew up in Chicago, and she said, you know, my dad encouraged me to start volunteering when I was 12. So in seventh grade, I started to tutor after school at the Sue Duncan Children's Center near where she went to school in the south side of Chicago. And she started to teach art, which really evolved into a passion for her. And she interned at Creative Time, which is a public arts organization, eventually served on the board, worked at Kickstarter to curate all of their arts in programs. I don't know if any people on the phone know Kickstarter, but it's a crowdsourcing platform where she believed that art could become more accessible to people who wanted to invest in it, as opposed to having to just have art sort of be for the elite. Recently, you know, joined the board of a museum as an art collector herself, so forth and so on. You know, all of this before the age of 25. So, you know, what Victoria illustrates for us is sort of this deep commitment of time to the nonprofit world starting at quite a young age. And so we went back to the data and realized that 90% of the people we interviewed started to volunteer before the age of 21, 75% of them before the age of 15. So millennials in particular, whether it be because their parents like Victoria's encouraged them to volunteer, or they had mandatory community service at school, or you know, organized opportunities to engage with their peers in volunteerism, but giving of time has become, you know, a critical tool in their toolbox. And I think a lot of nonprofits, you know, the one way they have to engage volunteers is their board. And they might not be engaging next gen donors on their board so readily. And it's an interesting challenge, I think, for nonprofits who want to figure out how to create meaningful volunteer opportunities for a generation who's looking for them. You know, similarly, talent is something that NextGen, you know, take very seriously. A number of people we interviewed, especially women, said to us that nonprofits often see them and direct them right to the Young Adults Committee or the Junior Board or the Fundraising Committee. The social, more social aspects or fundraising aspects. And this woman said, I don't want to be, you know, perceived as an ATM, or as a woman, I don't want to be perceived as a fundraiser. And so how do they, you know, how do the nonprofits see that NextGen donors have incredible skills of their own, whether it's because they're working in finance or have a law degree or technology skills, so forth and so on. You know, one woman we interviewed said, as an attorney, I was able to write legislation for an organization trying to advocate for changes in how school systems are able to give allergy medicine out to kids in schools, because usually the EpiPen is locked in the nurse's office and is not accessible and is detrimental to children's health. You know, so it's just interesting how that we found so many of the next gen who are willing not just to do anything. They want to do something. They don't want to just do anything. They actually want to volunteer in a way that taps into their skills and benefits the nonprofits they're serving. So time, talent, of course, treasure is evident. And a lot of people said, you know, if you can find a way to engage me meaningfully at a young age, you're going to have a loyal donor for many years to come, right? So while they might be giving at smaller amounts, at younger ages, they're also clear that as they earn more or step into more of their inheritance, that they're going to be significant donors over time. And then lastly, we added ties to this maxim, you know, that while many generations previous have social networks of their own, we found that there was something distinct about the way in which the next gen we were interviewing wanted to engage their peers. Rather than sort of seeing their social networks as relational quid pro quo, like you give to my organization, I'll give to yours, you buy a gala table for me and I'll buy one for you. They're more looking to their peers as sources of information, of sources of learning, of sources of strategy, you know, just like my metaphor, forgive me, is like, as you go into Amazon and you want to purchase something, you often click on a review and sort of look to other people who have purchased the same product for a review, right? Or if you're thinking about going to a restaurant, you may check out the Yelp reviews. You know, people are sort of looking horizontally to understand how other people are consuming products, preferring restaurants, and similarly, like looking to their peers to understand what are the most strategic nonprofits out there and how do I engage with them. So, you know, you see an increase in giving circle participation and crowdsourcing, use of crowdsourcing platforms and other kinds of collaborations, because I think that the next generation are looking to their peers and to their ties for that kind of learning and engagement and strategic advice. Perhaps in a way that older generations look to advisors for that kind of advice, the next gen is looking to their peers for that first.
I find all of this just incredibly exciting, Sharna, and think about how these little innovative and kind of mindset differences will ultimately shape how this new generation of donors and givers and doers is that the potential that you describe that they have is staggering. And you've mentioned the statistic, and I was with Dr. Paul Shervish about 2 weeks ago, and he told me that they have updated, that they're, I think they're in the process of publishing now an update to their survey that I think is probably the source for your, the number that you're using. And he's suggesting now it could be 3 to 4 times greater than what they thought 10 years ago or 15 years ago when that study was first done and released. They're recalibrating, suggests it's even more massive than what we first thought. And it is going into the hands of this generation that's going to revolutionize giving. Now, I want to ask you for a second if you would just put on your most cynical lens, and I'm not going to ask you to wear it permanently, but just for a few minutes, and tell us what worries you, what threats, what trends, what disruptive in a negative way influences could get in the way, could cause a stumble or a failure to achieve the impact and the potential that you and Michael suggest this generation is capable of.
Sure. First, I'm glad that you named Paul Shervish. Yes, he and John Havens did the original research on wealth transfer at Boston College Center for Wealth and Philanthropy, and that's definitely their research that I cited. So thank you for that. And I'm glad to hear they're doing an update, however staggering it is. You know, I think the question that you posed follows well after the one we just spoke about, in the sense that I know if NextGen are hungry to be engaged in meaningful ways, you know, giving of time, talent, treasure, and ties, that it puts a burden perhaps on nonprofits who want to engage them. You know, I often hear nonprofit professionals say, I'm focused on the mission and delivering services. And even if I'm focused on fundraising, I have now 5 generations above the age of 21 in American society to cultivate, and all of them seem to want a different approach to their engagement. So I do have empathy for the nonprofit organizations who, you know, want to capture the potential of the wealth transfer or the resources or the energy that the next gen have to offer, while at the same time knowing that they may have to adapt in order to do so. So I guess for me, the silver lining is I do find next gen, particularly inheritors, kind of humble about that, you know, admitting that they don't have all the answers, they don't have the solutions, and wanting to be in conversation with nonprofit professionals about what their needs are. But it will take a shift in the field, in the sense that, you know, there has been a power dynamic between donors and nonprofits. A donor gives and receives a benefit and an honor. And in some ways, I think the next generation is saying, I don't need that sort of power and recognition. I want to be a partner. I want to be in relationship. And I think it takes courage for a nonprofit professional to share not just their accomplishments, but also their challenges, to admit what's hard for them and what they need help with, that things aren't always perfect. But in some cases, I think the next gen really want that. In fact, we had one woman we interviewed who said, I'd rather a nonprofit who I'm meeting with to tell me what they need and to ask me how I might want to help. And if they don't want to do that, or if they feel like it's out of the scope of their mission, again, I'd rather that they say, you know, it's a little far afield for me, or could we do it this way? Or actually, I like your idea. Would you be willing to fund it? Because it's going to take extra resources to accomplish that. She said, you know, in the case where the nonprofit just sort of says, well, that's nice, let me think about that, she said, they never get back to me. And it's kind of the signal that I'm not going to be involved. So, you know, I gather that in this case, NextGen may seem high maintenance because of the way that they want to be engaged in such a rich way. And that can be hard on the nonprofit. And at the same time, I think if the nonprofits can approach it, you know, sort of knowing that the NextGen is earnest about the change they want to create and that they have a real collaborator who wants kind of an honest dialogue, and I think it can lead to a productive outcome. It's just going to take work, and I appreciate that. So that's my caution to answer.
We'll take those cynical lenses off, and let's go back to our very positive and purposeful view at this revolutionary generation. I think, Sharna, that one of the things that excited me the most about the points you've made with Generation Impact is that while it's very appropriate for us to label the rising generation as philanthropic revolutionaries, that it's surprising to learn that 90% of their values tap into the roots of their family. So while they're revolutionary, they're not rejecting, as many might suppose, the values of prior generations of their families. Now, as I speak to senior generation family leaders, and particularly the A-type entrepreneurs, the number one worry that they express is, you know, how can I be sure the wealth isn't going to ruin my family? They're ignoring the wisdom of Solomon that if you train up a child while they're young, they won't depart from that path later in life. What can you share with us about how the rising generation of donors has been influenced by the values of their parents and grandparents? And is there a story or stories perhaps that you might share that exemplifies how families have done that well and what a difference it has made?
Yes, that was a lovely discovery for us too, that the next generation, and we asked them, you know, how they approach giving, where they learned about the value of giving. 89% said that they are influenced by their parents and 63% by their grandparents. And I know that many parents and grandparents feel relieved at hearing this too. So in fact, our impact revolutionaries are not bomb throwers, you know, they're actually sort of earnest revolutionaries looking to embrace the values that they learned, even if it means deploying them in different ways, you know, responsive to the needs of the day. So I think about John R. Seidel, who's the grandson of Ted Turner, the well-known founder of CNN and the UN Foundation, among other things. And John R. talks about very, very clearly, you know, I was born and raised in Atlanta by good people with great morals, constantly emphasizing, you know, the values that they were conveying. In fact, the Turner Foundation, their family foundation, focuses on protecting and restoring the natural world. So, you know, one of their strategies was from young ages, traveling. John R. says he remembers traveling with Grandpa Ted and other members of the family on learning journeys to experience environmental and sustainability programs. You know, not only learning about climate issues, learning about people in other places in the world that he wouldn't have had exposure to if they had stayed in Atlanta, gaining the benefit of doing those journeys with family members and building those close relationships. But really the value of sustainability and of the importance of protecting the earth was embedded from a very young age, to your point. And, you know, he said, it hasn't led to me doing exactly the same thing as my parents and grandparents. In fact, they invited me to find my own way into it. And so he's recently become the director of sustainability for the city of Atlanta and is working from that posture on protecting the environment and creating sustainable programs. You know, and there are many others like him who we interviewed who said, we're very aware upon whose shoulders we stand. And this, we are stewarding a legacy. We want to honor that legacy. But I also want to strive to create, take what my parents have given me and sort of continue from there, one said, you know, continue to move up the ladder or plow my own trail, all those kinds of maxims, you know, how do I sort of take what they've, the values that they've transmitted and then and the legacy they've given me and then make my own way to affect change in the way that I can today. And I think John R. is a great example of that.
Well, thank you for those examples. And it's interesting to hear that there is a John middle initial in the Turner family. So this John A., that's be it John R. You know, John A. is also a famous Canadian name, and we have a number of Canadians on the call today, Sharnan. And while what the research you and Michael done have done is focused on the U.S., I'm just wondering if you could, is there any reason to think that it wouldn't be directly applicable to the Canadian experience?
So it's true that we didn't do research outside of the United States, but we've certainly worked and spoken to colleagues and other donor families around the globe, Canada, Europe, Israel. In fact, one of the women we interviewed, Sarah Ojays, featured in the last chapter, grew up in Geneva, and we met her because she's been living in New York for the last many years. And she talks about, actually not dissimilar from John R.'s story, but her parents set up a checking account, if you will, not even a formal philanthropic fund, but an account, and set aside some money for she and her three siblings in their teens to have a learning experience together, to learn to work together, to learn to make decisions together, to read proposals and do site visits. It enabled them to work with an advisor so that they would have some support, but it didn't have to be mom and dad, so they could have their own learning experience. One of the values transmission pieces too on that example is that their last parameter to their Sarah and her siblings was, we want to make sure you give 25% to the local community where we live, so that you can learn. You don't have to go far to make a difference at home. You know, that what started as a 4-year endeavor actually became a 12-year amazing experience for Sarah and her siblings, who say it's really changed who they are and how they work together and the work they're doing in the world now. So, you know, I don't think that it's just an American phenomenon. I know in each country is different, and kind of the way philanthropy is structured and incentivized is different in each country. So I think that, you know, has some bearing on how next gen, especially inheritors, are engaged. But at the same time, I do think a lot of these are universal phenomenon that we're seeing across the countries. So I don't know. I wonder if people who are on the phone who are from Canada would chime in as well and let us know what they think about the question.
I think that's a great invitation. And it's really, we're at the point where I do have another question or two for you, but we're at the point where we'd love to invite the listeners to become interactive participants. And the way you do that, Julie, can you let them know how to do that?
Sure. Thanks, John A. So anyone who would like to share a question or comment, please feel free to raise your hand by pushing the appropriate button on your dashboard there. And if we see your hand go up, we will open your line. You can also submit questions through the Q&A box. It looks like we do have one hand up. So Ginny, I'm going to open your line. Please go ahead.
It looks like...
Hi.
There you go, Ginny. We can hear you.
I'm sorry. I actually did not raise my hand. I must have clicked on something by mistake, but Sharna, I have read your book, and I love your book, and I really do. So this is not a question, since I didn't mean to raise my hand, but I will tell you that I really have appreciated you talking about the difference in impact and what they mean by impact versus what an older generational person might say, that of course they wanted to have impact. So thank you.
Thank you, and thanks for taking the time to read the book. I really appreciate your feedback.
So we'd love to have anyone else, and I'm going to, it's getting noisy in the corner that I've chosen here in the conference center, so let me quickly make this point and go back on mute. Could you, Sharna, one of the chapters you focus on the possibility, the potential of multi-generational teams and how important that is to these revolutionary givers, this new rising generation. And I would hasten to perhaps add not only multi-generational, but multi-gender, gender diverse teams. Could you speak to the importance of that?
Sure, I'd be glad to. You know, when I started in the field, I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, I felt like the conversation was situated around succession planning. Advisors were serving G1, if you will, helping them to figure out how to plan one day to pass the baton. You know, how do we set up the systems, the structures, the vehicles to be able to make that kind of a transfer of wealth, of leadership, et cetera. And, you know, what I couldn't kind of wrap my head around was that we didn't actually see a baton passing. You know, we more saw that there wasn't two generations passing that baton anymore. There were actually five generations above the age of 21. So I think I mentioned this before, but really, if you look at the average lifespans in the United States, and I know Canada and other first world countries are very similar in lifespan. And, you know, the average lifespan of someone in 1900 was 47 years old. So you could imagine that someone was sort of running the family business and at that point preparing to pass the baton. But now, you know, 100 years later, 100 plus years later, the average lifespan is more like 79 for men in the United States and 82 for women. So you literally have five gens who are over the age of 21 and around our family and our nonprofit tables. And so, you know, we wanted to sort of emphasize that it's not just a planning for something imminent in the future, but it's actually a multi-generational engagement now. It's less of a relay race and more of a fielding a team together. So, you know, we found that the next gen, you know, on the heels of sort of learning their values of giving from their parents and grandparents and respecting legacy, they're okay with being part of a multi-generational process. In fact, you know, if you think about having started to be engaged in giving and volunteerism at a young age, they're ready to go, you know, by the time they're in their 20s and 30s. They see that there's often a foundation or a fund or significant giving going on in the family, and they want to be involved, and often not just, you know, as part of the discussion, but a decision maker. And I would go one step further to say that they actually think the giving will be better off, will have more impact if everyone brings their unique skills to bear on the enterprise. So, you know, if you think about the metaphor of a team, you wouldn't sort of field all first basemen on a baseball team, right? Everyone has to play a different position. So, you know, how can the elders bring their wisdom and experience, and how can the next gen bring their know-how of technology and sort of a more global world to have an impact on the giving that the family is doing? And I think they would argue sort of the same about gender, although I have to admit, Jonay, it's not a question we asked explicitly. So I just want to be clear, it's my editorializing rather than what's in the data. But, you know, assuming that everyone comes to the table and brings their voice and therefore makes the team richer for it, you know, we heard people say, we don't just want to be the successors to our elders. We want to make this a true family foundation. So, you know, we don't just want to join the kids' table, but we want to join the main stage. And, you know, again, I think that that's just like nonprofits are trying to navigate how to engage multiple generations of donors. I think families similarly are trying to figure out how to invite everyone to the table and make sure people have a voice. It's actually a lot of the work that we do at 2164 is helping to build that system of communication, of healthy process, of leading with values, you know, being in conversation together, helping people feel like they're on the same team to affect the kind of change that they want to create or impact they want to have or success that they want to have as they would define it. So, you know, I thought this was important contribution to the conversation, because often we think about next gen, as we've talked earlier about, being the disturbance generators willing to go out there and take risks, but, you know, at the same time, they're the first to say, I'm willing to be part of that multi-generational team. Just tell me, you know, just invite me to the table.
We have a question that's been submitted, Sharna, that I really love. And I'm going to read this question. Curious if there was a defining moment, Sharna, when you realized you would do this work, kind of an aha moment after which you reviewed things after which you viewed things differently. Could you talk about that?
I appreciate that. You know, what comes to mind is, honestly, I think I was 24, and I was attending a conference. I went with my parents to the Jewish Funders Network conference. And that year, someone on the planning committee asked me to be on a panel. And I can't exactly remember the topic of the plenary, something about the Jewish community of the future. But, you know, they said, feel free to sort of take a next-gen stance on it. And so I called a lot of people to, you know, gather my own data to make sure I wasn't just speaking from my own voice. And I sort of offered some insights about how I thought the next gen were perceived as being, you know, young and not on people's radar, but that actually many of us were adults now with educations and experience and of our own desire to participate and engage in meaningful ways. And I don't know, I'm sure I said some other things, some other bold revolutionary things at the time, provocative things maybe is a better word. And I was shocked by how it was received. People actually appreciated me naming some of those things. And I realized that while I was going on my own personal journey of finding my role in my family's philanthropy, I did later join the board of the Goldsecker Foundation when I turned 29. But I also had perhaps an ability to empathize with my peers and translate our experience across the generations. You know, I'm an admirer of Sean Aker's work. He's a positive psychologist at Harvard. And he says, you know, we take in so much data during the day that our brain has to naturally sort it. And so 10% of the data in our brain are the observations we make, and 90% is what we make of those observations, of the stories we make of the data. So what I realized is that everyone, you know, just goes through life based on their events and conditions that they experience and sort of take in the data, but make stories of it that make sense from their vantage point, from their generational perspective. And so how do we help everyone empathize or see each other's generational perspective, how they come to the table so we can work together across the generations on whatever we want to make an impact on. So I think for me at 24, that was definitely a light bulb going off that this might be some of the work I can do in the world.
Thank you for sharing that, Sharna. We'd love to have any other comments, questions. If you do, Julie has put up on the screen for those who are coming in through the internet, the way in which you can ask a question or offer a comment. There's two different ways outlined there. We'd love to have you participate. And Sharna, I am going to just do another shout out of gratitude here. I know how difficult it is to do the research, to make the effort to connect with people, to do the in-depth interviewing, to assimilate all of this, to organize it. And not only have you and Michael done an incredible job of that, but I also believe the work you've done to create the discussion guide that could follow on is extremely helpful. And could you maybe talk just a little bit about where we can get Generation Impact, what are the outlets that it's available through, and talk maybe about where our listeners might go if they would like to go deeper with you or learn more about the book or the project?
Sure, I appreciate you asking. We have set up a website for the book and resources around it, generationimpactbook.org. We're grateful to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation for making a grant, 2164, to be able to develop a discussion guide and other tools. We actually have a tool now called Time, Talent, Treasure, Ties to help people look at how they've allocated their resources in previous years and how they want to consciously or intentionally allocate their resources in the year ahead. And there are other best practice guides and other tools coming online in the next year. So that's generationimpactbook.org. And I guess I would say that, you know, while I had my own experience at 24, what it reminds me of is how this next generation, this Gen Impact, they too are in a stage of life where they are becoming. Right, Jonna, you introduced me to Jeffrey Arnett's work on emerging adulthood a number of years ago, where, you know, we understand that many of these people, you know, whether they're earners or inheritors, are developing their own philanthropic identity and becoming the donors that they will be now and in the future. So, and when we asked them how do they want to learn, the number one response was through personal experience. So, you know, I hope people will read the book or read the stories within them or look at the discussion guide or pick up some of the tools, you know, values exercises or legacy conveying exercises, whatever it is that helps them have a conversation with next gen donors who are their children, their peers, their nonprofit board colleagues, you know, their advisees, whoever it may be, their friends, their loved ones, to engage in this conversation, especially during a meaningful time in those next gen donors' development journeys.
And I'd want to remind everyone on the call today that there is a very valuable role that advisors, consultants, family office professionals can play here in encouraging this offering a spark to make those conversations happen or possible. So sometimes just a little bit of positive prompting from the advisor, consultant, or family office professional will be the key to making that conversation occur. I think we have two more questions. So let me first, Julie, could you open Jenny's line? And Jenny now has a question for Sharna.
Hi, Sharna. So now I actually do have a question. So, when I very first started this work a number of years ago, I always assumed that families were going to bring me on board to help them become more strategic in their philanthropy and engage the next generation. And what the parents started saying to me is, oh, we're so disappointed with this philanthropic experience. We set up a family foundation and now we're just spending it down because they don't want to be involved. And we are very disappointed with the whole process. So what I ended up doing with a lot of families was actually working with the individual members, especially the younger members of the family, on, you know, values and even a discussion about what money means to them, leading into just the family discussion of family values, family vision, mission, before we even got to the philanthropic side. And the reason my question is, and it comes out of a statement you made earlier, really early in this conversation, when you talked about how your father and I think and uncle were having to deal with philanthropy before they even figured out who they were as people first. And I'm wondering what else you do with next geners who are still struggling while they're emerging adults, basically. What other things do you do with them before you involve them in the philanthropic process?
So I appreciate the question, and I have two answers for you. You know, one is I'm reminded of a story of an administrator at NYU at New York University who was asking a group of incoming college students, you know, how many of them read the newspaper. He was trying to get at how many of them were civically engaged and would participate in the life of the university, and very few raised their hands. And then, you know, one teacher suggested if he should ask the audience how many of them watched The Daily Show, got their news on TV. Uh-huh. A lot of them raised their hand. You know, and he realized that the way he was asking the question actually missed where the next gen were. Uh-huh. So sometimes I find when parents say, you know, my kids are not interested, I'm just going to spend it down. You know, I say, okay, well, we can always do that, but why do you think they're not interested? What does that look like? How is disinterest showing up? And they'll say, well, I offer them to come to meetings and they never come. And I'll say, well, what time or what day are the meetings? And they'll say, well, they're in the middle of the day, you know? And the kids live in another city and work and aren't able to take off of work, for example. So sometimes I think just pausing and making sure we understand to ask the next generation directly, you know, what's going on here for you? Are you in fact interested? You know, what would help you be involved? Sometimes actually is a helpful intervention before we do anything else. Uh-huh. That said, I actually really appreciate your approach of sort of going at the identity formation of the next gen first before going to grant making. I think many organizations and advisors say, you know, what cause do you care about? And next gen aren't prepared to answer that. They're more thinking about who they are, mm-hmm. before they get to what they want to fund. So, you know, 2164 has developed a lot of exercises, which you're welcome to check out on our site, 2164.net. Some sound like those that you use, whether it's a values exercise. We also do exercises around money messages. So, mm-hmm. you know, what are the messages around money that you heard growing up that inform who you are and how you see the world, and what do you want your money messages to be around wealth and philanthropy? Sometimes that is a very freeing experience for people. Looking at family history, family narrative is a very positive, you know, experience. Research shows that families who share their family narrative with their children, the next generation have greater self-confidence, greater self-control, particularly the ones that share the highs and lows of the family story. The next gen feel that they too can be resilient if their predecessors have been, so they're willing to take some risks and try new things. That research is out of Emory University, Marsha Duke and Robin Fibish. So we have storytelling exercises, looking at family legacy and how they can play a role in that. And also just inviting them, no matter what age they are, to think about the vision for the kind of world they want to be in. We have a deck of image cards, so we ask people to choose the images that speak to them about the vision for their philanthropy, you know? So not specifically what do you want to fund, but kind of what's the vision you're going after and how do we help you get there? Uh-huh. So I hope some of those are helpful practical exercises, and I'm happy to talk offline at another time if that's helpful.
Yeah, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I know that some parents have said things like, well, this is the way we want to begin the conversation about money or teach them about money is to get them involved in the Family Foundation. And to me, from experience, it has raised a red flag, because I think it needs everything else that you just mentioned before some of them get there. So thank you.
Thank you.
We have Natalie Wagner has her hand up, and your line is open, Natalie, if you have a question or comment.
I do have a question. This has been a fascinating hour. Thank you, Shaina. This is, I've learned a lot. My question is very broad, and I know we're at the end of our time, so maybe if you can note one to three things that come to the top of your head. So we've talked a lot about the differences from the philanthropic perspective between the generations. I'm wondering if, Jenny mentioned it just a moment ago, what money means to them, to these different generations. Maybe on a bit of pulling out the lens sense, what are some of the differences that you see between the generations with regard to how they view money or what it means to them?
That is a big question for the end of our time. I'm curious, what are some of the differences you think you see across the generations?
Oh, good question. Well, I think that money means different things to younger folks in the sense that the fantasy of wealth has been popped a little bit, that people understand now that money doesn't necessarily make you happy or safe or loved or even necessarily warm at night, just depending on what you're doing. So money for the sake of money as a pursuit, I think, has changed quite a bit. And so I think people are more interested in using it with impact, with purpose, and less interested with accumulating it, more interested in the impact or in the profound usage.
I think that's beautifully said. I'm not sure I can do a more eloquent job. I would say we've seen that the expression of money comes as an extension of people's lived experience. So, for example, traditionalists born between 1925 and 1945, who grew up amid the Great Depression and post-World War I, the onset of World War II, for example, you know, changes in the economy, like they often, their expression of money is often one of saving for a rainy day, right? Mm-hmm. Of if they're going to give, you know, giving to their community, their God, country, and fellow man, you know, investing in institutions that will be there permanently. And, you know, if they've had success, they want to give back to that community where they earn their resources. And some of them are comfortable putting their name on things because it's a sign of leadership, right? They want others to follow them. Whereas I do think you see, certainly in the millennial generation, more of a purpose-driven economy, right? A sharing economy of how do we sort of realize their scarce resources. And as you said, you know, not use them just for personal gain, but to make everyone better. So I think a lot of it is about as asking people, you know, who are you? What did you experience during your formative years that inform who you are and how you see the world? And that allows us, you know, some insight into how people see money as a tool for that or philanthropy as a tool for change. So I would love to continue the conversation, Natalie. I'm sorry we don't have more time, but I like the question you're raising, and I hope we get to continue the discussion.
Yeah, I do too. Thank you. I just have one quick thought that I'd like to share is I think the worldliness of the different generations has played a big role. You know, in the below 1950, very few people had traveled the world, especially not with the frequency that some of these younger people have and had when they were growing up. So I think a sense of how everything comes together as a web is part of the difference as well.
Agreed.
Well said. Thank you, Natalie. Sharna, we have one written question submitted, which I think is an appropriate way for us to end. This individual said, I'd like to hear a little bit more about the trainings that 2164 offers and how Generation Impact fits into that. Can you sum that up? And if it's appropriate and there's a way to have them connect with you through the web or through email, suggest how they might learn more.
100%. So since 2008, for the last 10 years, we've been offering two-day trainings to other professionals in the field, those serving next-gen and multi-generational families, not specifically around philanthropy, but more about taking a multi-generational approach. So our first two-day training is about that multi-generational approach, and after that, we have follow-on trainings specific to family dynamics, talking about money, the art of facilitation for those people who want to facilitate family meetings. We're putting together one now around Generation Impact and next-gen donors. Anyone who signs up for a training is welcome to be part of our ongoing network of webinars and sort of being in community with peers who are interested in this issue. Because I think sometimes people work freelance, you know, work independently and don't have peers, or they're one individual within a larger institution who's mindful of the families behind the work they're doing and sort of looking for a peer community focused on this issue. So we're just hoping to offer our know-how, experience, and our tools to enable other advisors to deploy them in whatever industry they're working in. So you're welcome to go to 2164.net. It's just 2164.net. And if you click on what we do, you'll see the listing for trainings and the upcoming dates. Happy to follow up with any of you if you're interested.
Thank you very, very much, Sharna. This has been awesome, and we can tell by the energy we generated through the follow-up and the questions that it really resonated well with our listeners today.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
You bet. Thank you so much, Sharna. Bye now.